I'm holding in my hands what I consider a remarkable, remarkable book. It is one of the most thought-provoking 260-some pages I've ever come across. It is called The Last Excellent Man, provocative title, yes, The Meaning of Our Jordan Year. The author of that, who's also a publisher and does a variety of things, is an old friend of mine. Mark Vanzel, congratulations. This is quite a book.
No, you're too kind, Rick. Thank you.
How did it come? What's the seed of this book? When did you say to your lovely wife or your kids or to somebody, you know, I'm gonna write a book?
So the seed goes back to 1998, and was right before Game 6 when the Bulls came back and won their second three-peat.
Three-peat.
And I described this in the book, but it was total chaos. I mean, it was like traveling with the, you know, you were mentioning the Rolling Thunder Review. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was fascinating. The hotel lobby at all hours, day and night, was full. Police were positioned at the elevator, in the elevator. When you got out of the elevator, you had to have secret code words. And I was trying to finish a book with Michael.
Yeah. And well, you've collaborated. Let's go back. We can go all over the map because you'll be on for an hour. You and Michael have collaborated on four books or three?
Five.
There you go, Rick. Good guess. Five books.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of them, he was, you know, what something I think about Jordan, he must have, in the same way you write in the book, that he got death threats virtually every day.
Mm-hmm.
He also must have gotten, hey, Mr. Jordan, I'd really like to do a cartoon book of you or make a T-shirt of you. I can't even imagine that. What was it that made him collaborate with you, that intrigued him enough to do that? I the pitch is in the book, and it's very effective, but tell the listeners.
Well, I never asked him for anything.
Yeah.
And I treated him like a person when I was a reporter. You know,
right.
No one's perfect. You can't write that way, even if you admire someone and what
sure,
they're doing.
Sure.
I remember one case, and I think I always think back to this. He was supposed to do an appearance. It might have been at a hospital or something, and he didn't show up.
Mm.
And so somebody called the newspaper. I just happened to be in there.
Where were you working then?
Sometimes.
Okay.
And I just thought, actually, here's an opportunity to be honest and open. He's not perfect. He's not a god. He is a human.
Mm.
And I wrote about it. And I tried to get a hold of him, give him a chance. And he never said a word about it because I took him to task for it.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
I mean, come on.
Sure, sure.
And I think he respected it.
Interesting.
And we grew up the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about that. You grew up, he grew up. Yeah, the other thing I had forgotten. That if life were, you know, the dial of life was a little different, he would have grown up in Brooklyn.
Yes.
And his mother thought that would have been a disaster. I'm not sure why she would have thought that, but I can imagine some reasons. You grew up west of Chicago.
Right, out in beautiful, bucolic Sycamore, Illinois.
And Sycamore's a good town.
It
I like
is a
Sycamore.
Good town, yeah.
I like Sycamore.
I remember when the population sign changed from 7,200 to 6,900 to 7,200. And my mother insisted that she knew everyone in town and no one knew was there.
Who are these new 300 people?
Right,
who are
right.
these people? Who are these people? And you went, well, one of the things, Mark Vanzel, this book, The Last Excellent Gentleman, which you can get at Amazon and maybe even at a local bookstore, it's partly, I think, a memoir. I know you're such a self-effacing guy, and you always have been. But I think there are shades of memoir in this book that I greatly appreciated.
Well, thanks.
Do you feel that or no?
More than I would feel comfortable saying it.
That's the definition of self-effacing. Yeah.
Where this came from is I was describing, it's back to the same thing. I'm sitting on this couch with Michael and in his palatial suite. Bunch of guys, celebrities are playing cards. And I kept asking this question over and over and over again. You know, 5 seconds to go. You're down by a point. Time out. What do you think? And I wanted to get – I really thought there was something else I needed to know that no one knew about. Because I couldn't understand why him.
Yeah.
I could never understand the answer to that question. And I go, I asked it about 20 different ways. It's,
sure.
You know, being a reporter, you know how
too.
To do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And finally, he just falls back on this couch, and he said, are you asking me, am I thinking about missing the shot? And I said, well, yeah, it's a, the kill or be killed moment. You either make it or miss it. Might not even get the ball. And he said, and he was like a child. He said, well, why would I think about missing a shot I haven't taken yet?
Yeah.
And man, honest to God, Rick, I looked at him and I thought, that's why you're you.
Yeah.
And it's this profound life expression in the moment. He's never 1 second before, 1 second later. He could miss 9 shots in a row. They're over.
It is that proverbial in the moment kind of philosophy.
Which is very rare.
Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. No kidding. And you write in here that it is easy. It is. There's a myth about perfection.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no myth about excellence. The gist of the book, and there are a lot of themes in here, Mark, all of them provocative, that one can attain excellence. True?
Yes. So, you know, Malcolm Gladwell famously talked about 10,000 hours of practice. That's what it takes.
Yeah.
And then there are other guys who are talking about myelin, how myelin grows from the time you're born up until about 30 years old, which in myelin sort of surrounds nerve cells, like imagine piping,
right,
being
right,
insulated.
Right.
And there's a little bit of truth to all these things. Herb Simon, the Pulitzer or the yep. Nobel winner, talked about this 10 years. It takes 10 years to become, and he studied artists, musicians.
Right.
And came to that conclusion. But none of them hold up, you know. And you think the ability. So right, let me go back a little bit. In the early 90s or 80s, I went to a spiritual retreat and sat and listened for 4 days, 5 days, Deepak Chopra and a bunch of other people talk about meditation and what happens and what you're trying to achieve. And as I'm sitting there, I'm listening to it, and he talked about how everything's the same thing, right? This table we're sitting at, molecules, atoms,
right,
quarks,
right,
bosons,
right.
Everything. And a thought is made up of the same thing, so that you can affect the reality around you by what and how you think. And that you have to let go. So you might have something you really want to accomplish, but if you can squeeze the life out of it. The best example of that to me was Al Gore, you know, in 2000.
Sure.
He didn't want to be president. You know, I mean, because he didn't let Clinton go to either of the states that could have made him president.
Yeah.
And so you have to let it go. And so the first book, I mean, I'd been thinking about a book since I was 18 years old.
Wow.
And I sent away for things.
You did. No, and you did. You did your research. You really did your research. You really did your research. And Michael said yes.
Yeah.
Maybe not that easily. Maybe
I mean, to God bless him. He, I stood by the door that went into the trainer's room where it was off limits for media.
Sure.
And then I said, okay, 60 seconds. He goes, all right. I give him my pitch, and I tell him I guarantee him $1 million.
And he put a nice pitch.
That classic smile. He goes, "So you have $1 million?" I said, "Well, not yet."
That's great.
And he trusted me in a way that I don't think I would have trusted me.
That's interesting. Another great story is Colonel Parker, Elvis's Svengali. When Jerry Weintraub came to him and said, hey, I'd like to manage Elvis, he goes, come here tomorrow with a check for $1 million. And Jerry Weintraub did. We'll be back in a couple minutes with Mark Fancel talking about his latest book, The Last Excellent Man. I'll have him kind of define, if he can. There are a lot of definitions, and there's a lot that goes into becoming an excellent man, and it's man or woman.
Mm-hmm.
You make that very clear. Up front. We'll be back. Welcome back. We are in the midst of Mark Vansel's career, and Michael Jordan's career because they were on sort of similar paths. Talk to me, though, Mark, about your growing up and becoming a journalist. I find it, you know, your dad worked at a gas station, right?
My dad, my dad went in the Navy. I was born very quickly after the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back from the Navy, and there were, in this little town of Sycamore, less than 7,000 people, 21 gas stations.
Wow.
And he and another guy opened another one. And when he died, he had the longest running independent business in the entire county. And
wow.
it was only three left.
Growing up, when did the, and I think it came relatively early, the journalism bug hit you?
Well, I was
you delivered papers.
You were a
delivery boy.
Yeah, that didn't influence my journalism.
No, of course not. Yeah, right. This Tribune's too heavy.
but I was an athlete. It was a small town. You could play. And, I was an ad. I mean, I learned math from sports.
Of course.
You know?
A lot of people did.
Yeah. And, so I got in high school, and that's the first time you could actually, we had a newspaper, and a friend that I'd grown up with my entire life, Dirk Johnson, and I joined the newspaper. I probably joined it because he did.
Yeah.
And you had to be a senior to get any editorships, but he became the editor, and I became the sports editor. And we ended up winning an award to go to the University of Iowa Writers School, yeah, which was fascinating. And while that was Dirk's mission, is to be a writer, it just was sort of a means to an end for me. It was just, I just kept getting jobs. Which sounds self-effacing, and I don't mean it that way. I was interested. I had a little bit of a discerning view at that age. I read books.
And you wanted to cover sports, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. I wanted to be in the NBA, but I was 5'10".
Okay. So first, well, it's like Abe Saperstein, who was like 5'3". Who gave you your first job?
The first job I got was the Sycamore News, and I was in high school. And the woman lived down around the block from me, and I wrote her a letter, and it was just the arrogance of youth. Like, you know, this is what's wrong. You need perfection.
You should have started the letter, of course, you know my mom.
Yeah, exactly. But she was so kind and said, okay, you know, I'll give you a chance. And I probably made like $2 an article.
Yeah, right. Sure.
And the last thing I wrote for them was I went to the 1976 Democratic Convention in New York and wrote about it for the paper.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And then I went to Florida to school, and Marty Kaiser.
The great Marty Kaiser.
The great.
Wound up at the Daily News, and then he wound up at the Milwaukee Sentinel.
Won a bunch of Pulitzer Prizes.
Yeah.
And Marty was the sports editor at the Clearwater Sun.
Wow.
And Sandy Bailey was the assistant sports editor. And I ended up, years later, working for Marty at the Sun-Times and writing for Sandy at the Washington Post.
You know, it occurs to me that you got in the business, you and Dirk, at years after I did, but also at the right time, where there was this coterie of inspiring mentors.
Yeah.
Absolutely. A correct phrase?
Absolutely.
You know, you met people like John Shulian and the young Mike Downey and David Israel and all this stuff. The romance of journalism at the time, it was not really the front page days, but it got to you, didn't it?
Well, it did. And this was, you got to remember, All the President's Men, and who didn't want to be Redford or Hoffman,
you know?
Yeah. So, but it was also I liked the competition part of it. I really liked that.
Yeah.
And it was fun being the underdog, you know. And you know, you'd meet your contemporaries at the Tribune down at the Billy Goat.
Sure.
And it was just a great time. It was probably same in the NBA. When I got to the NBA, it was the perfect time to do what I was doing.
Yeah, I agree.
You know?
In that sense, Michael came around at the perfect time. And one thing that struck me about the book is when the world combines to make unusual people, that Michael Jordan was like literally a foot or more taller than anybody in his family.
Yeah.
I know that's mysterious, but what do you make of that?
I don't know, and he doesn't either.
I know.
Like he thinks he's curious about it. Like how does that happen? And then he says, and then I have this special talent.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Yeah.
Because you can't see it anywhere else. And he talks a lot about his older brother Larry, who's 5'8".
Right.
And the same guy.
And who would challenge him to one-on-one all the time. How do you look at it? You were trying to get, I think, in this book, to kind of sort of to the bottom of this whole thing that is the mystery of life. It doesn't obsess Michael, does it? Or does it?
No, and that's what's fascinating.
Yeah.
So I talk about in here not just him, but...
Oh, no, a number of other people. Yeah. Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift is fascinating to me. Because 2023 is the other year where she blows away all records relating to live entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And when I dug back, and I've always been curious about her, but as I dug back in, when she was 10 or 11 years old, didn't have a guitar, didn't play, but she knew what Jordan knew, what Andretti knew, what Cash knew. They knew something.
What Beyonce knew, what Caitlin Clark knew.
Steve Jobs.
Yeah, Muhammad Ali.
They were connected to, the best way to think about it, is the God within.
Yeah.
And no one around them could see it or understood it, but they did.
Yeah.
So it wasn't hard work for them. It was just a means to, you know, they were doing what was natural to them because they saw themselves in a place that we can't imagine.
Yeah.
You know,
That is so true. You really bring that to the fore in this what I consider remarkable book, The Last Excellent Man. Define that for me. What's an excellent man, woman?
Well,
you don't discriminate in there.
No, it's not. I'll tell you what it's not. It's not about the points. It's not about the trophies. It's not about anything that we can apply metrics to.
Right.
It's all the other stuff. It's character, fearlessness. Nobody's a victim. The fearlessness of these people, as the expectation goes up and up and up and up, they never are any different. And that, you know, Jordan's a great example. I mean, it's not about the money, and yet he makes all the money.
Yes, exactly. And with some of the stuff in the book about how little Jordan was paid when he played is astonishing to me. We're spending the rest of this hour with Mark Vansel, the author of many books, The Last Excellent Man, The Meaning of Our Jordan Year. You can buy it at Amazon. We'll be back after the news. Welcome back. I am still in conversation with Mark Vansel, the author most recently of The Last Excellent Man, The Meaning of Our Jordan Year. He spells his last name V-A-N-C-I-L. I won't insult you by telling you how to spell Mark, but the book is available anywhere, and it is. He has spent much of his publishing and writing life in collaboration with a guy named Jordan. You still talk to him?
I do, yeah. You know, our lives have diverged. He's a multi-billionaire, and I'm not. So you know, I don't park my ship anywhere near his or anything like that. But, yeah, he's a good guy. I mean, he's just a really good dude, especially for the life he's led.
Yeah. Well, one of the sections of the book that will haunt me forever is about, it's not too long, but it is about his dad.
Yeah. Well, his dad was a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
And you can see, if you knew Dolores, his mother, and you knew his dad, you could see how Michael would be the outcome of those personalities. Mm. James was just a jovial guy, always smiling. Everyone loved him.
And he would take off, which I didn't know or had forgotten, that he would sometimes just take off for days and go and drive around and
you know,
explore the world.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, we all know how these things work. I mean, you've probably been married for 40 years, 50 years, and, you know, you get your own little things that you do, and that's what he did.
Yeah.
And he was a guy of the South. Like, it was safe to him, you know? And so...
That happened around the time your book was coming out.
Yeah, it was,
and that was a, and it, it makes for fascinating reading, Mark. But how you had to deal with that?
Yeah, it was. this was before the cell phones.
Yeah,
and so I got home. In fact, my wife and I went to where we were going to get married, and they, you know, they feed you dinner and tell you how great it's going to be. And I get home about 11 o'clock. I had to fly to Portland, which is where we were going to, where we were printing
print
the book.
The book, yeah.
And about 11 o'clock, and there were 30-something voice messages.
Wow.
And they got progressively more awful.
And angry.
Yeah, by the end it was, our lawyers, everybody's lawyers.
There's a man at your door with a gun. Yeah.
Right. And so by then it was, nothing fazed me. So I thought, okay, whatever. You know, no, when you stopped and thought about it, are they really going to throw all this away? No, they're not.
Yeah.
So, but I also wasn't going to get a hold of Michael. And no one was going to get a hold of him through me under the circumstances.
Sure, of course not. Yeah.
And so I got up in the morning, flew out there, and with my lawyer. And on the plane, I figured out, you know, we'll move this photo over here, and I put in a...
I think you came up with a great
solution. You know, the printing of this book, my father passed away. He was my best friend.
Yeah, he's my best friend.
And, you know, I told him that I did talk to Michael, and this is what he wanted me to do, and everybody was happy.
The other, another fascinating... I'm telling you, people, this book will give you insights into all manner of things. Bob Dylan also comes up in the book, The Last Excellent Man by Mark Vansel. The story about Oprah and the sort of pressure she put on you, and my, you tell that story so well, it really sort of makes me sick, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, I always tell people, I think I'm the only person that's ever yelled at Oprah Winfrey,
yeah,
you know,
and survived.
And survived.
Yes.
But she
lived to tell about it.
Yeah, I mean, this was right after he had talked to nobody.
Right.
Just in the funeral that happened, the book was published, and she desperately wanted him on. And so I negotiated for weeks with her producer and said, you know, you can mention it, but
you
not belabor this.
Yeah,
it's,
you cannot
very,
do the Oprah deep dive
right
into, yeah.
And so anyway, we have this agreement, and I'm sitting in the audience. Everything's going fine. And right before, I think, the second intermission, or what do they call it, break, she just starts in on him. Your father. But Michael, he was murdered.
Yeah.
Murdered. I was so livid, and I had nothing to lose.
Right.
You
right
know, I mean, I was out of my seat. I was going to go right down on the, and tell Michael, get out of here.
Yeah, I don't
and
blame
I
you
didn't, because his wife was sitting there, and I would have embarrassed them. And at the end, I apologized to him, and just the guy he is, he said, you know what, it's not worth it. We travel in the same circles. And I thought, it is worth it.
Yeah,
I don't travel in those circles. And so I ended up having a boisterous discussion with Oprah.
But then you sort of, you didn't quite make up, but you were at something
later,
with Obama's and something.
Yeah, in Obama's first election, I you know, donated some money and went to an event at her house out in Mendocino. And it was just odd, you know, sort of an odd thing.
Yeah.
But
did you remember you?
No, wait, and I didn't even meet her.
Oh, okay.
You know, and there were hundreds of people there, but...
You write, here's another great insight in the book, and I could talk to you for hours about this. You can also, I'm going to write about a Mark in the book in next Sunday's Tribune, which will be online, because that's the way newspapers work on Wednesday. you write in here, during, this I had not known, during Jordan's playing days in Chicago, he quietly made visits to local children's hospitals. I don't recall ever seeing those acts detailed in local media. That doesn't mean they weren't. I don't remember that either. Like nearly all of his philanthropy, Jordan's acts of kindness are personal and executed quietly. His commitment to Make-A-Wish Foundation notwithstanding. There are elements, I don't want to say they're secret facets of Michael's personality, but... They kind of are. You know, he's not having people write about like what it's really like to go play golf with he and his, you know, 35 high-rolling partners.
Yeah, I remember asking him once, you know, he brought it up, something about, you know, everyone says they want to be me. And his answer was, he said, I would always say, yeah, you would for about 30 days. Nice house, nice cars. But after that, not many people would want to be me. And his the example he used was, he had little kids at the time.
Yeah.
And he lived in a nondescript house just across from Northbrook Court.
Wow.
You would never know the house. It was any different than anyone else's. And he wanted to go bike riding with his kids. And these cars kept pulling up, and he was terrified they were going to hit one of the children. And it was that kind of stuff.
Or like, kidnap them or something.
Or something, yeah. But it was just, that was constant. You know, it was, I'll tell you another quick one. We were in Vancouver, and went to this fancy restaurant after a game. It's late, and all the security is there, and you got to call ahead. And we're sitting with a bunch of the players, Pippen and Harper and, you know, people with enough money.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, a small fry.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
And so the check comes, and I said, you know what, Michael, we're going to make money on this book. Let me get it. He goes, okay, big shot. He hands me the check. I look at the check, and it's like $2,000. And no one else.
Dinner.
No one else offered.
Well, Scottie Pippen, as you know, one of his nicknames is No Tippin' Pippen. That's pretty common. I want to read something else in the book, just to try to induce you people to buy the... You quote David Halberstam in the book, because he wrote about Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote of Jordan's game as performance art, "This is sports as ballet, something utterly new and modern. Its roots African-American. Ballet is a contested sport. No one, after all, guarded Baryshnikov. Jordan's is the most original of performances." Do you ever go back, Mark Venzel, and watch him play? And there's enough out there on YouTube, you know, all over YouTube.
Yeah. You know what's odd about it? Is you go back and look at it, and it's not 4G. You know, we're used to such fine detail.
Yeah.
And it looks old.
Oh.
Even though it's spectacular still.
Yeah. Looks like a Three Stooges routine or something.
Yeah.
We will take one break and then come back and finish off this, what to me is a fascinating hour of talking to Mark Venzel, with his wife Laura sitting here taking care of her man, as any woman and or man has to do if they were crazy enough to marry a writer. We'll be back. Mark Venzel was just telling me how fascinating his career has been, and he's not kidding. He's been all sorts of places, and I just said to him, having shared many moments in that career, that that's the way newspapers used to be.
Yeah.
That's the way newspapers used to be. We had it, you know, you and Dirk Johnson and a couple. I was at a birthday party, 90th birthday party for Ron Grossman, the writer for the Tribune. And most of the people there were, it was lovely. They were all, most of them older than I am. We just talked about, it was a good time in newspapers. It really, really was. What is, Mark Venzel, the stuff you do for Williams Conference Global?
It's inference.
Inference, sorry.
Yeah.
Can't even read my own writing.
No, it's okay. It's an odd sort of concept. So this was started by a guy named Jim Williams, who was a total iconoclast.
Yeah.
His father started the Williams Soap Company, and Jim went to the best schools, read the best books, and he was an odd and interesting, fascinating person. So we had a mutual friend, and a few years before Jim died, this mutual friend, after hearing the stuff that I've done, he said, "You got to meet this guy." So we drove up and met him, and one thing led to another, and, you know, I ended up taking over the company.
Wow.
And with my friend's direction.
Sure.
And so the way to understand what we do is, back in the 50s, in the Cold War era, but this has been going on a long time, there were certain kinds of spies that were called readers. And so we had them all over the world. We had spies in Moscow and St. Petersburg and everywhere during the Cold War. And they would read everything they could, and they were looking for the unintended message. In other words, an anomaly, something. They would look at the backgrounds of pictures. They would read the want ads. And so this one guy in Moscow notices that a soccer team up near Siberia, which historically had been awful for good reason,
yeah, sure,
won a game. By itself, doesn't rise to the level of a huge anomaly. And paid attention to it, though. A couple weeks go by, 4 or 5 weeks go by, and not only are they winning, but they're killing teams. Something changed there. So U2 spy planes were relatively new. We had pictures of the area.
Yeah.
And this guy sends this information into what's called a weaver, which is what I am now. And the weaver takes all this information and tries to make sense of it.
Wow.
What is this telling us? So the most basic thing is that something changed.
Yeah.
Is it important? We don't know. We send a U2 plane up. Sure enough, new pictures come in. There's a heavily guarded, heavily camouflaged tower and a two-story building next to it. They have a secret nuclear program going on.
Wow.
And you found it through this arcane way. And it goes all the way back to the Russian military of old, where the weaver was a general at that level.
Yeah.
And all these bits and pieces would come in. In fact, even in World War II, we sent guys out all over. And I can't remember who this one was, a famous fellow, if I can remember his name. And he came back, and Roosevelt said, "So what did the Russians say?" And he goes, "It's not what they said."
Well, they didn't say.
They want aluminum. And Roosevelt said, "Why?" And he goes, "Because they think they can win the war. Because there's nothing you make with aluminum that doesn't take a lot of time."
It's fascinating. How do you read so much for this job? Has it affected your writing at all?
Yeah, yes.
Because this book's beautifully written.
Well, thank you.
I could pull up almost any page and read something very nice. Has it affected you in that kind of personal way?
You know, as reporters,
yeah,
you're always skeptical.
Yeah, tell me about it. Yeah.
And so what it's taught me is to be even more skeptical about even more.
That's great. I think that's good.
I mean, for example, I think, you know, one of the things now, these metrics that the government puts out have no, they don't correlate to actual people's lives. And so it looks like a great economy if you're the top 15% or 10% or 5%, but not for the rest. And I think that also explains to some degree Trump's victory.
Wow. Interesting. What's your next book? I mean, a book like this for you must have been. You've done 5 books with Michael.
Mm-hmm.
You've done books about, Major League Baseball, Dan Marino, Treasures of the Hard Rock Cafe, Yankees book, WWE with some guy, Cash about Johnny Cash,
mm-hmm.
Interesting guy. And Ken Griffey, this is a vastly different book, and it must have on some level really empowered you.
Yeah, it was the most personal.
And yeah, no question.
As we discussed, you know, when you're a reporter, and you never lose that.
Right.
Even though I've gone on and done other things, you never use words like I, me, my.
Yep.
You're supposed to be an observer. And I felt like the story I needed to tell, which was a pretty broad, you know, kind of tapestry, I had to be part of it in certain places.
No question.
For the context.
Yeah. And it's wonderful it was wonderful for me as a reader when you would come back into it. I'd go, oh, man, Mark's back again. This is great. Tell me about this. But back to my question, is if it's empowered you even a bit, what do you think your next book might be?
The next book is, again, inferences help me on this, is titled right now, Scaled Addiction. And then the subtitle is The Greatest Business Model Ever Invented.
Mm.
So as we were discussing, if you put $100 into this company 100 years ago, it would be worth $250,000 now. Has nothing to do with technology, has nothing to do with cars, nothing to do with energy, no oil, electricity. It's Philip Morris. And if you look throughout history, you know, and it's everywhere. And you can identify these things like sugar, Coke, McDonald's. If you were making an ETF, for example, you'd have Philip Morris, you'd have Coke, you'd have McDonald's, you have Google, because it manipulates. I mean, yeah, what they found out is how to manipulate the brain and the pleasure centers. And then you'd have what we're seeing now are the antidotes, Ozempic, all of these weight loss drugs, and many others. And we've thrown the part I have a problem with the culture today is that we've thrown all the guardrails off. So, like the NBA, the last thing you need to do is encourage gambling.
Yeah,
and now they all are.
Well, you are, and you.
But it's a
touch upon it here. Well, to be, you know, they tore down the Tribune printing plant, and I will be amazed if they build a casino there. I will be absolutely. They say they're going to, but I'm thinking to myself, if I lived in Des Plaines, why wouldn't I just go to the Rivers Casino? Yeah. Why would I come here and say, hey, come on, honey, let's go stay at a hotel on the Chicago River, and lose all of our money?
Yeah.
You don't think? Do you think gambling can be indeed, it can be dangerous for individual people. But do you think there's a bigger danger here for society?
I do, because it's not just gambling.
I mean, think
of all the Schedule I drugs that are out. You know, ketamine, psilocybin, pot. I mean, we've let everything go, and that sounds like an old man talking. But I have children. I think I look out and I go, why was all of this not okay 10 years ago? And now it's all okay.
Right.
And I think we're approaching a really significant top in geopolitics and markets.
Well, that's chilling. I believe you. The chilling part is I believe you. That's what's really chilling about it. I cannot tell you once again how much I devoured. Mark's looking at it. It's got about 800 orange tabs of things here. And it's another great line of Jordan's. He went, Viola Davis is going to play my mother. That's what he wanted.
That's right.
What Michael got. How many books do you think, Mark, before I let you and your lovely wife, Laura, go home, how many books have been written about Michael?
Oh, my gosh.
It must be 100? 50?
Probably.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And none, except for yours, with his cooperation. I guess he cooperated with Bob Green, I suppose,
but
not financially or anything.
Yeah.
What do you think of The Last Dance?
I thought it was really interesting. Yeah. I mean,
And are you stunned? I mean, are you stunned? You know this person better than almost anybody. It's, you know, I think the same thing sometimes when I think of Royko, that Mike's been dead for pushing 30 years, and he's the subject of a one-man play. People will talk about him all the time. Those kind of potent individuals, Michael is still as famous as anybody still playing. LeBron.
You could argue anybody in the world.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you may be right. You may be right. It is great to see you again.
It's great
to meet your wife, and I can't wait for this story. See, I am on the radio. You know that. You're listening to me. But what I do is write. And so next week you'll see a story about Mark in the Chicago Tribune.